I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. The headlines are important as I turn to Professor Steve Cohen to discuss the week's events and look forward to the visit of the elected president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, to address a joint session of Congress and visit with the president in these next days, due Thursday the 18th. The headlines from Kiev. Right now, Ukraine, the MPs in the members of parliament have approved what is called an historic deal to move towards the European Union. At the same time, those MPs are said to have approved an amnesty offered to the rebels in the east of the country, an amnesty that has been characterized as a sellout and a betrayal by other MPs. This was all done within these last hours. At the same time, the ceasefire in place since the Cardiff-Wales meeting of NATO, the second day, that ceasefire is said to be holding while I mentioned there is artillery fire and rocket fire reported at Donetsk Airport and the Donetsk city, which is one of the large cities of the Donbass region, and around Mariupol, which is an important city on the way to Crimea. The Azov Battalion volunteers are said to be at Mariupol. That's the battlefield report. The professor is here, however, to turn to the larger scale matter. Good evening to you, Steve. Now that we've settled that the civil war continues, except not really, and everybody's making these what look to be concessions, where are we in terms of Moscow, Kiev, and Washington? Good evening to you.
John, hi. The professor, as you call me, though we've known each other for decades, is going to do a flashback. I have argued since we start talking about this crisis, probably in January or February, that this was a fateful crisis. And nothing that's happened in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere else in the world has diminished the reality that the Ukrainian crisis is going to change international politics and therefore history probably forever. We are already in a new Cold War. And this crisis unfolds, and there's been a dramatic change in both military and political fortune in the last 4 or 5 weeks. About 5 weeks ago, the American media, Kiev, Washington, Europe, was utterly convinced that Kiev, the regime in Kiev, which we back 100%, as you said, the president of Ukraine is coming to Washington this week, it was assumed with great happiness that they would crush through their bombardment and their shelling these two pro-Russian cities in eastern Ukraine, and that therefore Kiev, Washington, and NATO would dictate terms to Russia, to Putin, and it would be over, and we would have won. But I said to you 4 or 5 weeks ago, that's a big assumption. It's one thing for the Kiev army to sit X kilometers outside these cities and lob artillery shells and mortars and bombs from planes onto civilian capitals. It's another thing to take those cities, and they never even tried because they knew they did not want hand-to-hand combat with the rebel army. Meanwhile, the rebel army was regrouping, no doubt with Russian help, but we don't know how much. And in the last 3 weeks, the rebel army has routed the Kiev forces in southeastern Ukraine, routed in the sense that the Kiev fighters have abandoned their heavy artillery, sometimes ripped off their uniforms, and fled. So the rebels now control eastern Ukraine. That has transformed the political situation, and today, though it began a couple days ago, the president of Ukraine, the head of the regime in Kiev, who came to power through a coup and then got elected by part of the country, sued for peace. There's no other word for it. He sued for peace. Behind closed doors of the Ukrainian parliament, and I think there's no precedent for a closed-door session, the MPs didn't want to be seen voting for this, he gave eastern Ukraine what it had wanted from the beginning. Briefly, home rule and amnesty. Not complete. And he said it was only for 3 years. But 3 years is an eternity in a crisis like this. And he did one other thing, he being Poroshenko. He told the European Union that the trade agreement he signed with the European Union, and now remember, the whole crisis was precipitated when the previous president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, who was chased from power, refused to sign this trade agreement with Europe because it excluded trade with Russia, on which Ukraine is dependent. Poroshenko said, "I've signed it, but let's don't really do it, please." So they put it off to the year 2016. Imagine this. And the explanation was, both Poroshenko's and the European Union's, that it's necessary to sit down with Russia, with Putin, and figure out how Ukraine can trade both with, on favorable terms, Europe and Russia. And that is exactly what Putin proposed in November 2013, before one soul died. Now 3,000 people have died. 1 million Ukrainians have been turned into refugees because Washington and NATO wouldn't accept what Putin proposed in November 2013. Their blood is on somebody's hands. Let God or history judge. But as we stand today, the Kiev regime has been defeated. And now the question of negotiations and what will come out of it is, of course, something we should discuss.
Yes,
what I have
will.
To admit I don't understand is why Obama is bringing Poroshenko not only to Washington, but to address a joint session of Congress. I'm old enough to remember or being told that that was an honor given to people like Winston Churchill. Why is a Ukrainian oligarch who is an accidental president and whose short term of rule has led to total defeat in Ukraine being not only brought to Washington but to address Congress?
Four institutions I write down quickly, Steve, are at risk from what you just presented. Kiev, clearly, the government there is wobbly to non-existent because these votes today, one to move towards the EU, another to offer independence to Novorossiya or independence to the Donbass, that is not accepted by the parliament and all the parliament, and there's turmoil in Kiev. The second institution that's at risk is NATO. We'll discuss that. Philip Breedlove having very aggressive remarks to say about what he intends for NATO in response. NATO's right now conducting or is finishing conducting military exercises in Ukraine while there's fighting going on in Ukraine, a non-NATO country. And there's a large effort in Kiev to move NATO, to move Ukraine into NATO just as it wants to move it into the EU. Third institution wobbly is the one you just named, the U.S. Congress. There is no unanimity as to how to treat Poroshenko's visit and his demands for lethal aid. The State Department says, no, we will not give you lethal aid, but clearly his country has not been able to defend itself. And the fourth institution, and we'll come to this in the course of our conversation because you've underlined it to me, Steve, is the Kremlin. The Kremlin is now, what you'd have to say, wobbly because of the events in Ukraine and because of the threats of the new Cold War. So let's begin with Kiev. Poroshenko is coming to Washington, but he is not coming as the leader of a unified government or even representative heroically of the Ukrainian people. I read, and these are anecdotes, but it's what I see from bloggers and those who are sympathetic to Kiev, that there are very loud voices calling the political class rotten. That's the same voice we heard last fall in the first Maidan. Well, they're threatening a third Maidan. Perhaps it won't be the military commanders from the volunteer battalions. Perhaps it'll be the professional class in Kiev. But Poroshenko's nobody's idea of a Churchill or a unified leader in wartime.
I think you've got it right. And the only amendment I would make is that Maidan got transformed. I think it's fair to say that when folks, Ukrainian folks, gathered on Maidan Square in Kiev in November 2013, then December, then January, tens and then hundreds of thousands, and stayed there in protest to the previous president's refusal to sign the trade agreement with Europe, that things were mainly, in the beginning, middle-class, student, educated, democratic-minded, liberal-minded, pro-Western folks. Demographically, that's about 19% of Ukraine, Western Ukraine, but an important part. But Maidan got hijacked, and I don't care what people say, the facts are in. Ultra-nationalist fighters formed into militias, really tough guys. throwing Molotov cocktails, hijacked Maidan. And they, some of them, are, and I use this word correctly, semi-fascist, quasi-fascist. They openly identify themselves with the Ukrainian armies that collaborated with the Nazis in killing Jews and Poles during World War II. The people who led that pro-Nazi movement in the name of Ukrainian nationalism are their heroes, Stepan Bandera and others. These people are the ones who drove the president, who had just signed an agreement, a compromise with Europe for early presidential elections, from office. These people are the ones who are leading the battalions, the militias, that are fighting with the regular Ukrainian army in the east, and which it's not clear Poroshenko can control. So the threat of a new Maidan against Poroshenko is the potential of an extreme right-wing nationalist government in Kiev.
Just a moment, Steve. When we come back, we'll continue the threat in Kiev, the four institutions at risk on the present in information. Steve Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, author of Patriotic Heretic in the Nation and the New Cold War, speaking of the Kiev fragility right now with the president, the elected president, due in Washington on Thursday, the 18th, to address a joint session of Congress and visit with President Obama. However, events in Kiev in these last hours, a vote behind closed doors in the Rada, that's their Ukrainian parliament, has left no one happy. And Steve was speaking to the threat of coup, third Maidan, by the disappointed and saying they're betrayed battalion commanders. I mentioned, Steve, that the information is that Poroshenko has brought some of the most aggressive crypto-fascist, neo-fascist commanders into his own party. So he's looking to make a deal with the devil, but that's made everybody else unhappy about Poroshenko's reliability.
Well, maybe not everybody, because we're facing a situation where Europe is split. We can talk about that later if you want, about the Ukrainian crisis. Washington seems not to be split to the extent that we know where Obama stands. He seems to stand with the war party. There is a split developing as we talk in Moscow,
yes.
But you're right. The crucial split is in Kiev. Poroshenko is trying to form a political party because he dissolved the parliament.
He's called for elections next month.
That's right. So he needs a political party. So he's trying to co-op everybody he can who's a potential threat into his party. What he's giving them in return, we can only guess. But we have to ask ourselves, John, because it's unusual. Any parliament, we call it a Congress, is supposed to be the elected representatives of the nation deliberating and deciding. Which parliaments do their voting in secret behind closed doors, as they did today on the question of Poroshenko's concession to the east?
So you go along with the possibility of a third Maidan, in other words, a coup against the political class.
I mean, I don't go along with it, but I would say it's a real possibility.
Yes.
The problem is, who would lead it? I mean, you need, in such circumstances, a fairly charismatic leader. I could name names of Ukrainian ultra-nationalists, Yarosh, Tanibok,
Klitschko.
No, Klitschko, the former heavyweight boxer.
The mayor
candidate
of Kiev.
Yeah, he's the German candidate. He's too moderate. His moment passed, unless there's a grand compromise. No, it's now, if the situation is revolutionary, I hesitate to say it is, but it has elements of revolution. What characterizes revolution is polarization. As Yeats said, the center cannot hold, and everybody becomes passionate. There is no moderate force that has a leader who could contend to power. But the ultra-nationalists have several very vivid figures. The problem is, at most, they represent 19% of Ukraine's electorate. So Poroshenko is trying to fill the middle, to be the center, by co-opting people from the ultra-nationalist camps, the commanders of some of these militias. Will he do it? I don't know. But I do know one thing. And this is an irony of this outcome, a profound irony, almost an obscene one, when you consider how many people have died, that Putin wants to keep Poroshenko in power because he fears the alternative. Obama wants to keep Poroshenko in power because he can't imagine the alternative. Germany wants to keep Poroshenko in power because he's adopted the German program, that is, ceasefire and negotiation. So Poroshenko is a man with a base far broader abroad than he has at home.
But the list you just gave, Steve, doesn't have any skin in the game, and they don't have pointed at sticks the way the battalion's commanders do in
Kiev. Unless, John, unless, forgive me for interrupting, that the call made by Poroshenko's own prime minister, Yatsenyuk, two days ago, that Kiev, Ukraine, be immediately made an honorary member of NATO, so that Article 5, right, which commits every NATO member to defend any NATO member that's attacked, would apply Ukraine. It's madness. It's a recipe for nuclear war. It was not Poroshenko's idea. It's a criticism. It's a denunciation of Poroshenko's ceasefire. But his own government is split. What the West has in skin in the games is the West's divided perception of what's best for Ukraine at the moment, how to resolve the crisis, plus two other things. The West, as divided as it is, could give the billions of dollars that Ukraine needs, but you've told me on the show it doesn't have them, and they're not going to give it.
The IMF doesn't have it, EU doesn't have it, and they have other supplicants. In addition, Washington doesn't have it except for to make promises, and they won't give bullets. That's what Kiev wants. They want bullets, they want bombers, they want the NATO to show up and plant itself in Maidan.
I accept your financial analysis that the West doesn't have the billions. Oddly enough, Russia has it in the form of gas discounts. That's worth billions if they sell Ukraine oil, gas, which is not only for Europe but for Ukraine, at way below market price. So that would add up to a few billion a month, and at the end of the year, quite a few billion. But there, I don't rule out as quickly as you do that nobody will sell arms. You've got a growing clamor by the military commander of NATO, by the political secretary of NATO, by John McCain.
All right, let's talk
by the
NATO.
Prime Minister of Ukraine.
Just a moment, Steve. We'll talk NATO when we come back. I'm talking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian history about Ukraine crisis, and we go to NATO next and how fragile it is. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we're observing in transition the Kiev crisis, the Ukraine crisis, into what looks to be pulling in all of the institutions who've been participating in this dispute for many months, and they're now being thrown on their own devices. We've spoken of the vote in the Rada, the Ukrainian parliament, behind closed doors, both to join the EU, also to beat the drums to join NATO quickly, and to offer concessions, amnesty, surrender, there are many words for it, sellout is one that's being used in Ukraine, towards the Donbass, the rebels of the eastern part of the country. Now, Steve Cohen brings up NATO, Philip Breedlove, commander of NATO, making an address to the Atlantic Council in these last days, addresses the matter of a rapid reaction force being constructed to confront Russian aggression. And I underline, Steve, that there's no longer any pretense that NATO is for something like war fighting in Afghanistan against the Taliban or worrying about Libya and Gaddafi. They're looking at the original concept of NATO, which is that it's a bulwark, it's a wall, it's a fortress against the Russian bear. This means that the new Cold War not only is not going away, Steve, it's just now rearming itself to get ready for the next round.
All right. Now, maybe we disagree, or maybe I see something that you don't see and you see something that I don't see. An unexpected and unintended consequence of the Ukrainian crisis has been the utter profound split in Europe. Europe is NATO.
Yes.
Think of what split. We've known all along, you and I have discussed this over and over again, that Chancellor Merkel of Germany has wanted a peaceful resolution with compromises made to Moscow.
No military solution. Berlin says that every time you call him up.
Not only that, but she went to Kiev, Mrs. Merkel did, what was it, a month ago, stood before a press conference with Poroshenko and said there is no military solution. There must be a ceasefire negotiations, which he adopted. He after a slight hesitation and the military defeat he suffered, he embraced Merkel's position. But in reaction to Merkel, and Merkel is backed by Spain, France, and Italy, on the other side, which feels the war should be pushed on in the East because they identify eastern Ukraine with Putin and they want a showdown with Putin, are, it would appear, Poland, the three tiny Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and the United Kingdom. I don't know why Cameron signed on for this quixotic crusade. Maybe it's a replay of what Blair did during the Iraq War. And to the extent that we can understand anything Obama says, what he said in Wales and in Estonia 10 days ago appeared to ally him with the war party. So now you have a split in Europe, political and military. One wing, one party, one faction wants to arm Kiev to launch a new offensive against eastern Ukraine, which it now associates with Putin. That's a big mistake, because this is a civil war. But they're thinking proxy war now. The other faction in Europe, led by Merkel, is saying there's no military solution. It's a civil war. Too many have died. This is destabilizing Europe. It's spilling over into Europe's teetering economy. And we need negotiations, and negotiations are available. So that's where we are. I think we're at a Rubicon of this historic crisis. Either the ceasefire negotiation accommodation party, and it's not appeasement, will win, will prevail, or the war party will prevail. And then the war in the eastern of Ukraine will escalate, and it will bring us yet another step closer to war between America and Russia. And I think that's where we are now. And I don't know the outcome. But Poroshenko, who is not a great leader, who's a kind of accidental leader, who's a candy oligarch,
right,
he might rise to the occasion. The way, for example, I don't know if the analogy's right, Lyndon Johnson rose after Kennedy's assassination to carry the civil rights bill through. Sometimes in history, accidental leaders rise above their former selves and become historic figures. I don't know Poroshenko, but I do know one thing. Putin wants negotiations. And there's one other point here. The fighters in East Ukraine who are defending their territory, this is a civil war, have said, Kiev killed our grandmothers. They killed our wives. They killed our mothers. They killed our children. We don't want to live with them anymore. We want to be independent. But Putin will force them to stay in Ukraine if the West is ready now to negotiate. He will keep Ukraine whole with some kind of federal system. The question is, after all the blood shed, federalism in Ukraine, which was the obvious solution back in February and March, is it too late for federalism?
I want to get on to Moscow, Steve, but a note here on NATO. I'm not finished with it because it's EU, because it's also Washington, and Philip Breedlove is Washington. President Obama, in remarks last week before his speech on the Islamic State, this is a piece that ran in the New York Times. Peter Baker questioned those who had attended either the dinner on last Monday night or the meeting on the afternoon of the speech with the commentariat, and characterized the president's remarks. And at one point, the president, mocking Vladimir Putin, said, "What if I were to invade Mexico because there are some Americans at risk?" It was deliberate. It was ad hominem, and it went at Vladimir Putin. I mention this, Steve, because America is the war party in NATO, And that rapid reaction force is a real thing, according to Philip Breedlove. They're going to construct it. 4,000 people to rush like a fire brigade to wherever Putin is, because they're aiming at Moscow. They're not looking at anyone else. And I think that this calls into question NATO's credibility for the future, Steve. The president has the president of the United States has refused to use the word invasion, though there is plenty of anecdote and testimony that there were Russian paratroopers involved in that counteroffensive in eastern Ukraine. But the president uses the word incursion, and as if he's ducking. So after this, one measure of what happens is that I think NATO's going to have a meeting about what are we for? What's the point if we're not going to respond to something as provocative as Vladimir Putin taking over eastern Ukraine?
Well, there's also talk that NATO should intervene in Iraq to fight ISIS.
Yes.
Look.
And Moldova and Transnistria. They mentioned that now, Steve. Breedlove pointed to it in his remarks to the Atlantic Council.
Look, when the Soviet Union ended and Clinton unwisely decided to expand NATO, and the expansion of NATO was carried on by Bush, we've got 20 years of NATO expansion toward Russia's borders. Nonetheless, it's been essentially political expansion, bringing all of Eastern and Central Europe into the American sphere of political influence. But they promised Russia they would never put forward military bases in these new NATO countries near Russia. A faction in NATO, however, always wanted to do so. It was headed by Rasmussen, who's the political head of NATO, and he's been entirely candid. And when Breedlove became commander, the American general, commander of NATO, he picked up that mission. This has been the opportunity for them to do so. The 4,000 men are meaningless. Russia has a million men under arms. Or to take the analogy, maybe the rebels have an army of 9,000 men, maybe 15,000. But Ukraine, Kiev, has more than 50, 60,000 men fighting, and they've been defeated by this ragtag army of 9 to 15,000 men. What if 4,000 NATO men or women or troops, how are they relevant to turning back a Russian invasion of Estonia or Poland, which is not on the Russia's mind? It's complete nonsense. But there is a serious reason here. They are saying, as they said in Wales at the summit 10 days ago, we have to build infrastructure right for those men. Infrastructure means bases. And that means that as we talk, ground is being broken for NATO military bases on Russia's borders. That's a transformation of the expansion of NATO, which was political. Now it's going to be military. They don't care about the 4,000 men. That's nonsense. What could they do? I mean, Putin personally could judo and knock all 4,000 out. The point is, they want to build airstrips. They want to build communication centers. They want to build barracks. They want to build missile defense launchers. They want to build, if the INF treaty, the ban on intermediate nuclear weapons that Reagan and Gorbachev abolished is repealed, they want to put missile launchers in Poland, in the Baltics, mainly in Romania. It doesn't matter about the rapid deployment force. What they want are permanent bases on Russia's borders, and that's unfolding as we talk, and that is extremely bad because it means, I've said this 3,000 times on your show, and I'll say it one more time. The old Cold War, the military divide was in Berlin, far away. Now it's going to be right on Russia's borders. And how dangerous that is, whether due to mishap, provocation, intention, the shooting down of an airliner, doesn't matter. The point is, we become hair trigger away from war with Russia. And it is not for a day or two or a month or two, because this Cold War was sanctions, with NATO's military movement eastward, is being institutionalized. It's becoming deep. It's becoming prolonged. You've got kids. I've got kids. I got grandchildren. They may live through the next 40-year Cold War.
I'm speaking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University, Russian history emeritus, the author of Patriotic Heretic and the New Cold War. And now we turn to the fourth institution that is fragile or being shaken or is wobbly because of Ukraine crisis, and that's the Kremlin. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here to observe on the events of the week and looking forward to Poroshenko's attendance in Washington, a meeting with the president and an address to the Congress, but also how this is taking its own shape in Moscow, in the Kremlin. Vladimir Putin is the head of the Russian Federation, but Steve has very carefully laid out over months that Vladimir Putin is not the most hawkish voice in the Kremlin. And I introduce the fact that the sanctions regime is part of the new Cold War. So is Russia's counter, and we haven't seen it yet. But Steve, let's mention that General Winter is about to get his boots on and come riding. General Winter has won more battles for Russia from Borodino to Berlin than any other field marshal. Ukraine is aware of it, so is Europe, all of Europe, because General Winter means that Russia controls the natural gas lines that Europe needs to heat its homes and to run its industry, and in fact, for an economy whatsoever that is fragile right now. And within this last week, there was a news item that Poland was complaining that Russia had cut back 24% of the natural gas flowing into Poland. Why? Because I'm told that Russia anticipated that Poland would stockpile natural gas to reverse flow it into Ukraine to sustain the confrontation as long as possible. And Russia reached in there and stopped it. Russia can do more than that, Steve. They can reach in and stop all natural gas into Europe come the winter time. Vladimir Putin, does he control those levers of natural gas, or is there a war party ready to be more belligerent than even Vladimir Putin?
So you're right. So long as the ceasefire lasts in Ukraine, and there are skirmishes at the Donetsk airport at Mariupol, as you reported, but if the ceasefire holds, it means that negotiations probably have already begun. Now, understand what this means. Kiev called all the fighters in the east terrorists. They don't call them that anymore. Poroshenko has acknowledged their political legitimacy.
And just gave them amnesty.
Even said they can hold elections, autonomous elections, for their local political offices in, I think, November. So they're no longer terrorists. They're now representatives of the victorious rebel east. So now begins, if the ceasefire holds, it's a big if, John. We talked about why. The gas war begins, because I'm going to Moscow in early October, and I was asking my wife the other night, do you remember when we went in early October previously? And she said, yes, I remember it was snowing. So winter comes earlier to Russia and Ukraine. Russia, of course, holds all the cards. Remind ourselves, the European Union generally, and Germany in particular, gets about 35% of its energy via Russian natural gas. But the countries closer to Russia, Poland, the Baltics, Romania, Bulgaria, they get nearly 100%. So not only that, but Ukraine needs its own energy to survive. Its economy is in collapse. It was hoping for more coal. It's a large coal producer. But Kiev's own war on the coal-producing regions in the Donbass have closed down some mines and utterly destroyed the railway lines. They got to be rebuilt. By the way, Putin offered to help rebuild them as part of the compromise settlement. But now something's happened in Moscow, and let me report it, because I don't think it's been reported in America. It's not entirely about, but it's personified by a man by the name of Igor Strelkov. Strelkov is one of these guys out of Dostoevsky's novels. I think he's about 40, reasonably good-looking, women like him, a military commander, a colonel, who's fought in all Russia's post-Soviet wars. He probably worked for one of the Russian intelligence services at one time, but he's become an independent figure. He organized the military resistance in Ukraine when the Civil War became a fighting war. He reappeared in Moscow early last week, and he issued a public statement, and it was astonishing, and it electrified Russian politics. He has said, I have returned to Moscow from eastern Ukraine, because my work in eastern Ukraine is done. We won the war. The front line is now in Moscow, because there's a fifth column in Moscow that's trying to undo our military victory in Moscow. And we have come to protect Putin against himself. All right, deconstructed. What does that mean? It means that the ultra-nationalists faction in Russian politics does not trust Putin. It means that Strelkov and they are saying that there remain in the Kremlin pro-Western forces who are prepared to compromise in Ukraine in a way that would sacrifice the military victory of the rebel army and all the deaths it sustained. So the epilogue to that was a big rally was scheduled for, I think, Sunday. What's today, Tuesday? 2 days ago. All the nationalist forces were gathering. The leaders of the Donbass political system were coming to Moscow to speak, and Strelkov himself was coming. At least 100,000 people would have showed up. It was forcibly canceled by the Kremlin, the rally. So the Kremlin was worried about that. In other words, the Ukrainian crisis has unleashed in Russian politics a force not entirely or easily controlled by the Kremlin. And so now you've got, if you've got in Washington, as I've been arguing, in NATO, in Kiev, in Europe, a divide between the let's negotiate and compromise party and let's renew the war, you've got that same divide in Moscow.
Does this war party extend to these NATO war drums, Steve? The hawks on NATO and the hawks in the Kremlin exchange dark looks and then rearm?
Well, we know because it's not true to say that there's no freedom of speech in the Russian press. Television is controlled, but the newspapers are much more diverse than our own. The nationalists have their own newspapers, and what they write there is that we now have the commanding military hand, and we should march to Kiev. We should take Ukraine. After all, the West tried to take Ukraine, and we defeated them in the East. So let us take Ukraine. The moderate nationalists take the position, no. We just want to be sure that the Russian-speaking, ethnically Russian, southeastern part of Ukraine is not dominated by Western and Central Ukraine. And therefore, we advocate, and here they divide, either independence for that part of Ukraine, which would mean a partition of Ukraine, or a federal system in which the southeast would have its own political elites, its own elections, but would remain in a united Ukraine. That's a debate that's going to go on, and if there are negotiations, that will have to be sorted out at the negotiating table.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University, Russian history emeritus, author of Patriotic Heresy and the New Cold War, Poroshenko's Due in Washington. We'll continue our conversation next week. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.